earlier this month, the American Cancer Society updated its lung cancer screening guidelines. So what changed? And why change the guidelines now? Dr. Brian Wang joins us, and he is a noted lung cancer specialist with Hartford Healthcare Cancer Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Dr. Wang, welcome back to WICC. How are you?
I'm good, although your weather forecast just kind of made me a little depressed.
I'm sorry. I don't want to make a doctor depressed. That's like the worst thing, because if you're depressed, then there's really no hope for any of us. So
I'll try to muster through. It's good to talk to you, though, about this very important topic.
It is really important. And I have noticed recently in the past couple of years, a lot of cancer screening guidelines have changed or been updated. Why have these been updated now? What are doctors finding with lung cancer cases across the country?
Well, this is a good thing, and it's not necessarily because things are getting worse. It's just that we're finding out more. We're looking harder at things that we were suspicious about. And basically, the thing that changed is that before our guidelines were based on many things, including how recently you quit smoking, basically the burden of tobacco smoke in your lungs over time. And the early trials were based on certain criteria, and the guidelines that followed based on criteria that were used. And one part of this was quitting, having a certain number of pack years, what we call the amount of smoking you do on a day-to-day basis. And if you quit, you still qualified, but it had to be within 15 years to show that you still had a recent risk. But now with the new guidelines, we've expanded that, at least the American Cancer Society has, and the National Comprehensive Care Cancer Care Network included people who quit at any time. So current smokers as well as anyone who's ever smoked. So by expanding these guidelines, we hope to include about 5 million more people in cancer screening. And hopefully, based on the knowledge we have now, we could potentially avert 20% more in the way of cancer deaths. Lung cancer screening itself, by the way, has been shown to avert cancer deaths by 20%. So we're trying to build on that by including more people.
Wow. Okay. So to just give you the blank statement from lung cancer, from the American Cancer Society about lung cancer, it's recommending yearly lung cancer screenings for people now ages 50 to 80, used to be 55 to 74, who smoke or formerly smoked and have a 20-year or greater pack history. So like Dr. Wang just said, that is now going to potentially impact another 5 million or so more Americans eligible for the screening. It's a big deal. So it's a lot more people that could be screened. So what are the most common reasons for even getting lung cancer? Is it still smoking? Is that that's like the leading cause?
Yeah, 80%.
Wow.
Are directly smoking related. Yeah.
Wow. So why? Here's a question, though, I have for you, Dr. Wang. Why wait until 50 to get screened for this? Because people will start smoking cigarettes as early as middle school.
Yeah. In fact, here's a distressing fact for you that's also kind of come to light over the past couple of weeks, largely because it's Lung Cancer Awareness Month. Younger women below that age have surpassed men in the incidence of lung cancer diagnosis.
Wow.
That's actually been going on for a while now, and the trend continues basically across all age groups. But as far as surpassing men, it's creeping up. It's the younger women between 30 to 49. We're finding now that it's 50 to 54 and so on and so on. But why wait? Well, it's, again, because the original trial looked at the hardcore highest risk groups. And with time, we, I think, expect to expand the criteria even further, much like the major societies like the American Cancer Institute or American Cancer Society is expanding it to people who quit at any time. So I suspect, especially given the data in young women, we're going to see creeping down of the age, maybe even creeping up on the other end.
So we have Dr. Brian Wang here, who is a noted lung cancer specialist with Hartford HealthCare's Cancer Institute at St. V's. And we're talking about the updated guidelines for screening for lung cancer. That's really alarming, what you just shared, Dr. Wang. And how exactly do you screen for lung cancer?
It's a low-dose CAT scan. CAT scans are done more and more frequently every day for a variety of things. It's a pretty good tool for a lot of things, and we've adapted that to lung cancer screening. We've pared down the amount of radiation you get while keeping it a pretty good study so that we can find things like lung nodules. And you talk to your primary care doctor. Sadly, the vast majority of people don't talk to their primary care doctor about their lung cancer risk. About 70% of people, in fact, don't. People who should be, don't. Hmm. And far fewer even know that there's lung cancer screening using low-dose CTs. It takes a few minutes. You go in. It's not interventional. No one sticks you with anything. But it's basically a process where you talk to your doctor, you find out if you qualify, they set you up with an appointment, you go in, you get it done, and usually within a few days, in a lot of cases, the same day, you get a result. And then from there, you work with your doctor about dealing with the results, be it just kicking it out to another year. At the very minimum, we recommend a yearly screening. Or if it involves more frequent observation or even a referral to a specialist. There are even lung cancer screening programs. For example, Hartford HealthCare has a pretty robust lung cancer screening program where you're referred. Our navigator helps you see through the process. We've got a network of people. Yale has a similar type of program. So there are things in place to help shepherd people through the process, which can be otherwise a little overwhelming and bewildering.
We're talking all about lung cancer because earlier this month, the American Cancer Society updated its lung cancer screening guidelines. And we have Dr. Brian Wang here with us, who is a noted lung cancer specialist with Hartford HealthCare Cancer Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. So we've talked a lot about cigarette use leading to lung cancer, Dr. Wang. But how else can you develop lung cancer if you've never touched a cigarette in your life?
Well, there are other known environmental exposures like radon, certain chemicals in dry cleaning, asbestos. There are things in the environment that account for the other 20%.
Are you concerned at all with the increase of preteen and teenage children vaping, developing lung cancer down the road?
Yeah, I am. Here's the thing. It's still a relatively recent phenomenon. We don't have enough information about that. So we don't have the smoking gun, so to speak, like we do with cigarettes. But we do know that there are a lot of the same chemicals in vaping that lead to lung cancer. So it's just a matter of time. I'm convinced that within the next few decades, we'll see as these people get older, we'll have more data on that.
Are there signs that people should be looking out for when it comes to lung cancer?
Yeah. as you might suspect, it being a disease of the lungs, if you have symptoms like a persistent cough that won't go away, or certainly if you're coughing up blood, if you keep getting pneumonia over and over and over again. There are systemic, like through your whole body, things that you feel, loss of appetite or weight loss you can't explain, new pains in your chest or even your shoulders and arms.
I'm curious, is lung cancer one of those cancers that if you catch it in time, it's totally curable, or is this a very deadly cancer? Like once you find it, it's very hard to come back from.
Yeah, that it does get a bad rap because traditionally, once you get the symptoms and you present to your doctor, it's usually an advanced stage, and that's harder to treat. To be honest with you. As a reminder, you may know that lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States, in fact, the world. And if you take the deaths from breast cancer, you know, that's a lot. If you take the deaths from prostate cancer, that's also a lot. Those are leading causes in men and women, and colon cancer. And then you add them all up, lung cancer is still the one that causes the most deaths. It's pretty deadly, but to your question, it is curable, especially if we find it at stage one or stage two. It's very curable. That's why we screen. We want to catch them when they are curable. We have cure rates into the 90 percentiles, upper 90 even, depending on the situation. It's something that we can hopefully catch in time to shift those statistics toward a nicer looking outcome. Lung cancer screening is basically for people who don't have symptoms yet, but have those risk factors. And time and again, I've had patients in my own practice as a thoracic surgeon who've either discovered a nodule they didn't know because they started screening, or they'd been undergoing screening for a couple of years, and a small nodule gets bigger and brings it to our attention to do some intervention. And it's a very good outcome if we do catch it early enough. Absolutely.
I think based on the information that you've shared with us today, Dr. Huang, if there are people who are listening and they don't hit that age bracket where the guidelines are saying you should go get screened, basically what you're saying is if you were or are a heavy smoker, I mean, you should be able to talk to your doctor and say, I want to get screened, even if you're not 50 yet, correct?
That is right. In fact, and this comes down to insurance, like a lot of things. Mm. The insurance companies will pay for this stuff if you meet the guidelines. If you're in that group, and because this is an evolving field and we're getting new data, like the expanded guidelines, you know, we're pushing the envelope all the time, and we're trying to justify doing more tests, going to the insurance companies, asking for some exceptions. And we're trying to expand it even further to people who do have those kinds of suspicions, people who do have a heavy smoking history, even at a young age. Excuse me, people who have family members, so because there is partial genetic risk. If you have people dying at a young age of lung cancer in the family, those are all things that we consider. The bottom line is while smoking and exposure to smokers is are very well-known entities, there are other things that also might raise our antennae to want to look harder at people. Mm-hmm. So please do speak to your doctor and assess those risks and what you can do about them.
And certainly if you want to learn more from Hartford Healthcare, you can go online to hartfordhealthcare.org/cancer. Dr. Huang, I want to thank you so much for your time this morning and all this very important information.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us on.
Of course. Dr. Brian Huang, again, who is a noted lung cancer specialist for Hartford Healthcare's Cancer Institute at St. V's, right here on WICC.
For those that have done so much for us, supporting our veterans, now on Melissa in the Morning on WICC's 600 AM. And 107.3 FM.
We can't do this week leading up to Veterans Day without including Homes for the Brave and all of the work that they continue to do for our local veterans. Joining us is Vin Santilli, who is the Chief Executive Officer at Homes for the Brave right here in Bridgeport. Vince, welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. We're doing tremendous, and thanks so much for having us on this morning.
Of course. I want to start, Vince, by just talking to people about Homes for the Brave and how long you've been around. Could you share some of the history?
Well, yes, indeed. Homes for the Brave opened 21 years ago, and at that point, in the fall of 2002, accepted our first male veteran experiencing homelessness. And we've expanded a great deal since then, especially in 2022 when we opened the annex that you visited in downtown Bridgeport, and two houses totaling 15 beds for male veterans experiencing homelessness in West Haven, Connecticut. And we also have the first and only home in the state of Connecticut exclusively for women veterans and their young children right in the west end of Bridgeport. So we're trying to serve more veterans in more places, and we feel we're doing that at a world-class level.
Give me an idea, Vince, why 21 years ago there was this idea of creating housing for insecure, for veterans who have insecure housing situations. Like, where did this idea even come about?
Well, you know, our founders, which included Dr. Laurie Harkness and Tony Cinquanta from the Veterans Administration, just felt that there were things on the permanent side. And then, of course, the VA was there at the outset, but there was nothing in place at that point in time to help veterans transition from either military service or experiencing a brush with homelessness to becoming permanently housed, and that a program like Homes for the Brave would help our men and women become prepared to become permanent, to become housed permanently, I should say. And so that's kind of how that was the vision. And I think we've, you know, certainly I think really brought that vision to life, I should say.
Mm-hmm. And what's amazing, you started to talk about it, Vince, is the fact that in two decades, your services have expanded tremendously. I can remember back in the mid-2010s when I was working at News 12, and the big expansion was, we're not just going to house homeless veterans, we're also going to get them jobs. We're going to give them job placement. And it's now expanded to where you now have a chief clinical officer. We've had your chief clinical officer on our show before. You have an employment specialist. You have people who deal with legal matters. Tell us a little bit about the annex that you just mentioned that opened in 2022. What are some of the other services you're now offering for veterans and their families?
Well, Melissa, the annex really represents the expansion of our clinical program headed up by Dr. Stephanie Lynham, our vocational program, and our walk-and-drop-in veteran service center. And it opened in June of 2022, and this is for veterans and their families. And we've opened it really to the whole city as well. We have the dental hygienist from University of Bridgeport Fone School of Dental Hygiene come once a month and do basic dental education and teeth cleanings and so forth like that. AA meets there on Thursday evenings. And we've seen just scenarios there that we had never really seen in our residential houses, and like the middle-aged woman whose dad is an 85-year-old veteran and needs help obtaining hearing aids, and issues like that. We have an emergency food pantry there, and, you know, we have a wonderful intake case manager, Tito, who I know you've met, and who does just a remarkable job helping veterans who are struggling navigate the VA system and navigate really all the resources that are out there in the community for our veterans.
And I think, Vito, for example, does such a great job, because so many times, and you can kind of speak to this, Vince, that people come back from the service, and even if they've been here for many years since serving, there's so much confusion with, like you said, navigating what rights they have here in Connecticut and what is provided for them. And, you know, even down to, are there insurance plans specifically for veterans? Are there things that they could be getting that the general public doesn't, because they served our country? And folks like Vito make that happen. Is it as simple as just dropping by? Do people have to make appointments if they want any of the services like you just mentioned?
No, they could drop by, and Tito just, you know, serves almost, you know, handles it like a triage type situation, and then gets these veterans plugged into the resources that they really need. And as you mentioned, there's just so much uncertainty as to what our men and women are eligible for when they become a veteran and their military service ends. And so we try to really help them, you know, and inform them and then help them really in the process, because the paperwork and so forth could be so intensive.
It's very true. And again, we have Vincent Santilli here, who is the Chief Executive Officer for Homes for the Brave. Vince, you mentioned that you have two housing complexes for male veterans and you have one for female veterans. How is that going? How many veterans are you housing, would you say, on average?
Well, we have 62 transitional beds, Melissa. And just to give you an idea, the entire state of Connecticut, there's between 130 and 140 beds. For veterans experiencing homelessness across the state. And so in our programs, which include actually four houses, the our headquarters on Park Avenue in Bridgeport, our two houses in West Haven, and then our women's house, the PFC Nicholas A. Medeiros Home for Women Veterans in the west end of Bridgeport. And the big news about our Park Avenue headquarters, which has 42 beds, 37 of which are for veterans, is that we are expanding, renovating, and adding an elevator. So this is just a huge project. We are so excited about it. Construction started August 21, so we're more than a couple months in, and things are just a great deal is happening there. And by the spring, we'll have a new wing there with private suites, rooms with their own restrooms, with an elevator in the building that'll go from the basement to the third floor. And right now in November, so many folks want to honor or really memorialize a special veteran to them. And remember, as part of this project, folks can be part of the new Homes for the Brave, and they can purchase bricks, benches, naming rights to rooms in the house, to areas on our grounds. So I wanted to make sure your listeners are aware of that. And, you know, the bricks start at $250 and on up. So this is just a great time to really help us and become involved and help us bring this project to fruition, because costs have skyrocketed.
Yeah, that's very true. And again, if you wanted to learn more about that project and get involved, you could certainly go to their website, homesforthebrave.org. We have Vince Santilli here, who is with Homes for the Brave, Chief Executive Officer there. And we'll give you the website in just a quick second. But Vince, just a couple of little housekeeping points. Just want to know for folks who are looking for housing, especially because we have a housing crisis right now, what do veterans have to do if they are looking to utilize Homes for the Brave? Do you have any beds available, and how long can people stay?
Well, our veterans can stay anywhere from 90 days up to a max of 2 years, and those are per VA requirements. And, you know, the average stay last year was 120 days at our facility on Park Avenue in Bridgeport. And, you know, we do have some beds available, as the case might be. Our West Haven houses are pretty much topped out. There's only 15 beds there, and the beds are in such high demand because they're just a few blocks away from the VA Medical Center. And once again, we have the annex in downtown Bridgeport. Technically, it's Lafayette Circle, but it's really Fairfield Avenue. And that's a great way to access our services, because we've had a number of men and women come in there and say, hey, look, I just got an eviction notice. I'm going to have to be out by the end of the month. What do I do? You know, sleeping on and surfing, you know, couches of friends and relatives. And it's just I'm kind of wearing out my welcome. How do I, you know, take the next step? And those are all things that we can help them address.
So if you want to go online, certainly you can go to homesforthebrave.org. But Vince, if people want to call your offices, what is the best way to contact you?
203-338-0669 is the number at our headquarters. And the annex in downtown Bridgeport is 203-275-0600.
Okay. And again, that website is homesforthebrave.org. And Vince, I want to thank you for all that you do at Homes for the Brave, including your entire team like Stephanie and Ed and so many others who work with you. Thank you so, so much. And Tito, can't forget Tito. And thank you so much for always making the time to come on WICC. Really appreciate it.
Oh, Melissa, we thank you for your support, and it was wonderful to hear Paul as well. He and I had a chance to chat a little bit at our Step Up for the Brave, and again, we just are so appreciative of the support of you, Paul, and WICC.
Always. We love what you do. We love our veterans so much, and Homes for the Brave will always have a very special place in our heart and on our broadcast, so you are always welcome, Vince. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Again, Vince Santilli is the Chief Executive Officer for Homes for the Brave. If you want to contact them, start with the number 203-338-0669 or go online to homesforthebrave.org.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
I was actually reading an article not too long ago, the psychology behind excessive talking, why some people compulsively talk more than others. Speech, it's a huge part of how our brains are programmed to socially connect and even survive in this world. But some people may talk a little too much. Excessive talking is when you overtalk or you compulsively talk, and it could be a little too much at times. So let's talk more about the benefits of silence, the sound of silence. We've got Julius Dudix here, who's our morning show counselor, to talk about the importance of this. And if you struggle with this issue, and maybe you don't get a 5-hour talk show to let it all out in the morning, how do we stop talking so much? Right?
Good morning, Melissa. How
good
are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Thank you for having me back.
Of course.
Hey, what? I love your opening comment because, you know, some people are just wired to talk more. There are some studies, all kinds of studies. One study I read indicated that women use an average of 20,000 words a day compared to men who use about 7,000. Their numbers are all over the place, 10,000, 2,500. But the bottom line is, some people are wired to talk more, and that's okay. But silence is something that, a lot of people don't really understand the power of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what it can do, Melissa, it just gives you time to reflect upon your emotions. What am I really feeling? When you practice silence, you give your brain that opportunity to just rest.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you almost feel the emotions rather than suppress them, or you just remain on autopilot. Some people just work, and they can't be silent. I got one client that he's telling me right now, I can't be silent. I mean, it's too painful for me.
Mm.
And that's a hard statement. But some people are, they don't know how to practice silence. They don't know the benefit of silence.
Why is that, though, Julius, that people sometimes are hardwired to talk a lot? So it's interesting because this probably sounds very hypocritical for me since I literally talk for a living. But I actually love when the clock strikes 10:01. And the reason I love that is because I am not required to say a word until my son gets in the car at 3:30 in the afternoon. I love it. I love that I feel I get the bulk of my words out during work, first thing in the morning. And then I have the rest of the day to hear the birds chirp and listen to gospel music in the car and have my brain just sort of relax. Now, no one believes that because, again, of what I do for a living. But for people who know me personally, it's actually very hard to get me to just talk nonstop. That's something I actually don't enjoy doing other than in a professional realm. So why is it, though, there are people who really just you can't shut them off?
Yeah. And that could be the way they're, again, wired. It could be environmental. Was your mom a talker? Was your dad a talker? It could be heredity in your DNA. It could be a learned behavior. Maybe you had brothers and sisters that always talk kind of thing, and you just learn to be a talker. Or it could be a result of maybe growing up. Maybe one of your parents said, oh, she's a talker or he's a talker.
You know, she'll talk your, he'll talk your ear off. So a lot of it is, you know, why are we that way? Part of it is environment, part of it is heredity, and part of it is just the way that we've kind of evolved in terms of our own personhood and who we've hung around. Do you hang around silent people, or do you hang around people who like to talk? So yeah.
What about people who don't know, though, that they're talkers? You know, people who are not socially aware.
Yeah.
And that's... you know what I'm talking about.
I do. And that's that whole thing of self-awareness. And, you know, it's the ability to listen to people in terms of more in-depth. Looking at their eyes, looking at their body language, not just hearing words, but hearing what they're saying and how they're feeling, and then responding to it, as opposed to just, you know, letting the words, you know, come out, and it's almost like a verbal diarrhea kind of a thing.
Mm.
It's all a matter of how you train yourself. Are you a good listener? Or are you one who has to talk constantly? Are you one to, when you meet people, is it all about you, or do you ask them questions? Are you self-aware that sometimes I may be talking too much and I just need to, you know, God gave us two ears and one eye, kind of a one mouth kind of a thing. So, yeah.
Well, that's such an interesting phrase, though. And we have Julius Dudix here. I have heard that phrase since I was a kid, probably because I grew up a talker. But what I find interesting about that, Julius, is you have to train yourself to be a listener. And yet talking right. comes very naturally for most people. Why is that?
Right. Yeah, that's because a lot of times we tend to be more concerned with ourselves, our image, how we're coming across. If you find yourself, you know, I want to react to what this person is saying, so therefore I'm not really listening that well because I'm thinking in advance, how am I going to respond to the other individual? You know, that kind of thing, you can train yourself to do that, and all of a sudden you're a talker, as opposed to a listener. And it's always best to be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. And there's a proverb that says, even a fool is thought to be wise if he holds his tongue. And I can't tell you the number of meetings I've sat in, and I've thought about that. Because there are some people at a meeting who just love to talk till 11, 12 o'clock at night. But when you slow yourself down and give yourself that gift to process your emotions, to just be with yourself, go for a walk on the beach. There are so many psychological benefits of silence. I mean, creativity, your focus, self-control, self-awareness, greater perspective. It lowers your blood pressure. It just calms your racing thoughts. It gives you improved concentration and focus. It even helps your sleep. But if you're constantly go, and I never practice even 5 minutes of silence a day, it's helpful.
We're talking about the art of silence and how it can be really beneficial to be silent, but also to listen to people. Don't be so quick to just answer. A couple things I want to talk about with this, Julius. So one of the things that is a pet peeve of mine is when I'm having a conversation with someone, and you know that look, when you're listening to someone, or when you're talking to someone, they say they're listening, but you could see it in their eyes that their brains are running 500 miles an hour just waiting for you to end your sentence so they can interject or they could share what they think or change the subject. And there's nothing to me that is more of a pet peeve than when I feel like I'm sharing something significant or I'm having a one-on-one conversation and you're just waiting for it to be over so you can have the floor. That is one of the most infuriating feelings, I think, that happens in social interactions. I don't know how you feel about it, but it drives me crazy.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, you can get really, it could ruin relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But the best thing we can do is to communicate in the moment and look at the other person, look them in the eyes and just say, hey, are you hearing me? Are you listening to me? Are you hearing? Because listening is active. Listening requires a lot of effort. Listening is something that it's work. Hearing is just passive, no efforts involved. It's just more or less involuntary. I'm here, you know, yeah. And Melissa, I could remember a kid in high school that I could remember where today, and my mind is going right back there. Every time I spoke to him, he was always looking around at all the other kids walking down the hallway, and he wouldn't focus on me. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, Jiminy Whiz, you know. And so it made me think to myself, do I do that? You know, am I a good listener? And with couples, I love to do an exercise, communication exercise, where, hey, what did your wife say? How is she feeling? And then respond to it.
I love when you do that exercise.
Yeah, because the bottom line is what happens is we don't slow ourselves down. We don't become silent with our own heart. And a lot of times we don't even hear, but we're responding to some verbiage or some phrase that kind of cues us to a negative pathway, and all of a sudden we don't even hear what the other person says, but we're defending, or we're rationalizing, or we're shifting, or we're blaming. And that's not helpful in relationship. So it's always best to, again, quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry, but also, you know, what are they feeling? And a true narcissist, unfortunately, a true narcissist can't do that. And many times there's a negative silence, and that can be toxic. When you shut somebody off out of anger, that can be destructive and harm relationships. But that's something where a true narcissist couldn't respond to the question, what is your wife feeling or what is your husband feeling? They always shift, they blame, they rationalize. They could never get in the shoes of the other person because they're so self-absorbed. And you know, we've all got narcissistic tendencies, Melissa. And so we want to work on this. It's about becoming better people and not judging one another.
Right. Well, and I think something else that I've learned from having you on the show for as long as I have, Julius, is it's a great sign of where you want the relationship to go. So if you're in the heat of an argument and you're so focused on justifying your feelings, then you know that you're not ready to make things better or you're not ready to make things work. It's actually a really great exercise to see where, I don't want to use the word mature, because it may not be maturity. Yeah. It may really be that, you know what, I'm too hurt to forgive right now.
Right.
Or I am, you know, I'm too burned by this situation to have a relationship with you right now. I think it's a really great indicator. If you are not able to fully listen, not hear, but listen, and then be able to reiterate what that person is feeling, then it's a really great sign that you're not in a place for a relationship to move forward, whether that's a friendship, relationship, whatever it may be.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And the best thing is to acknowledge that. I'm not in a good place. I don't want to force it. So I just need a little bit of time and space. I need that gift of silence to help me reset, retune, retool, so that I can come back and be an even better and stronger person.
How do you do that, though, Julius? I think that's the big question. So this all makes sense when you're hearing what you're saying, but if you're a talker or you're not really a listener, and or you don't even know how to be silent, maybe you're a great listener, but the idea of being silent terrifies you. What do you do? Yeah. How do you start to train yourself to embrace silence?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, you have to be intentional. You got it with yourself. And this is part of self-care. You've got to schedule a time. For me, it's in the morning. You know, I love to sit in my office at 6:30 in the morning, and that's my time. And I schedule it first thing in the morning. For some people who are not morning people, it could be at night, or it could be at 3 p.m. But you have to be intentional and schedule a time to be silent with yourself. And you find a place, a place that you feel comfortable with. It doesn't have to be a specific spot every day, but for some people it is. You can even set a timer, 15 minutes. It doesn't have to be, you know, for a half hour. It could be even 5 minutes. And just quiet your mind. And maybe some people like to listen to soft music. Some people like to repeat calming phrases like, hey, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Kind of thing. But you've got to really be intentional and also communicate that intentionality to others, because there's nothing like, if you want to really get good at this, good at silence, it's always best to have maybe somebody you can do it with and say, hey, I'm really committed
to trying to have some quiet time with myself. And I want to bring some people on board with me to hold me accountable. That's another, you know, use your network kind of thing. And but the worst thing, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, if you needed help, like professionally, that's also not a bad idea.
Yeah, sure. And you can call the office at 203-243-7714, or you can look at my website, NJCC.online, not NJCC.online. And you can go from there. But it doesn't have to be me, Melissa. It could be anybody. But you just want to become a better person. And you know, the worst thing that can happen is for you to drown in your silence. And I've seen that happen before, where you begin to isolate to the point where, yeah, well, he told me to be silent, but I'm not really articulating how I feel to anybody. And consequently, that's when negative behavior happens. Mm-hmm. And I've got to have five glasses of wine instead of one glass of wine kind of thing. So it's always good to, yes, get silent, but make sure you're communicating your feelings. That is the best thing you can do, and not isolate. But practice healthy silence. It is cool. Maybe we're talking about meditation, yoga, that kind of thing. You know, but the bottom line is there are health benefits to it, and you'll feel better.
Yeah, that's very true. Julius, great topic. And again, if people want to contact Julius, great. If you want to contact somebody else to get professional help, this is definitely something that is going to help you with your relationships and with your own health benefits. And so I want to thank you again, Julius, for tackling this. It's really important.
Yeah, especially before the holidays. Don't stay stuck and just, you want to enjoy Thanksgiving and Christmas. So we're moving up to some good celebration time.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. Absolutely. Really good point. Julius, thank you so much. Always appreciate you.
Thanks for all you do, Melissa.
All right. Again, Julius Dudix here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning talks with career strategist and workplace expert, Julie Bauke. It's Julie on the Job. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Job unhappiness is at a staggering all-time high in America, according to national findings. In fact, data from 2023 shows about 53% of Americans are currently unhappy at work. More than half the population. They're unhappy this morning heading off to work. So we have been working to try and get Connecticut career happy, thanks to our career strategist, Julie Bauke, launching into week number three with this topic. Today, we are talking about tips and to-dos. How do we actually plan to find the job of not even our dreams, but just something to make us smile a little bit more than we are today? Hey, Julie, how are you?
Good morning.
Planning. I tell you, this is probably the hardest stage, I would think, is now putting the plan together.
You know, when we talk about, I'm just going to kind of just do a quick refresh here. This process, the first part of this process is figuring out what you want. And that is such a huge question that it feels like, how am I supposed to know that? But as we talked, it really is about even just breaking it down to what do you want more of? What do you want less of? Look at your situation today, your situation in the past. What have you been good at? What have you enjoyed? As we talked about the career happiness formula in week one, what do you want more of is a really important question, and it's a great way to get a toehold to start. So if you've gone through the process and said, okay, so here's what I want, here's some things I want to do more of, and then the flip side of that, of course, is here's some things I want to do less of. And then I always say, you always want to have that never again category as well, because getting clarity on that and then using the career happiness formula to help you figure that out, if you're able to say, given where I am today and given what I've done, here's some things I want to do more of. It's either because you enjoy it, you're good at it. The reason doesn't matter, but you've got to go through it and say, here's what I want to do more of. And then I don't want to do this stuff anymore. That's a start. That is a start, and that is a piece of information about yourself. Now, the temptation is to say, okay, that's great, but then we start falling into that. Well, it's just work. I mean, I'm not really supposed to enjoy it. Nobody's going to hire me for that. Who do I think I am? We start with all this stuff between our ears. And believe me, Melissa, I go through it too. We all do. So it's not that you're the only one having these thoughts, but you have to push past them. So the temptation at this point is to say, okay, well, I know I'd like to learn more about this. I know I'd like to do this. I know I'd like to add more customer contact. I'd like to add more, maybe some more remote work time. You know, what is it that would make your work life better? And start to articulate it. I'm a fan of having a place where you keep all these notes, and whether it's a pen and paper, or it's online, or it's an app someplace where you track these sort of things, or even just a good old Word doc. What are those things? And give yourself space to figure those things out. And then once you feel like you have enough to be able to articulate some of those things, the next question then becomes, how can I get it? Mm-hmm. Where can I get it? So the process of what do I want? Can I get it where I am? So if you're currently employed, the question is, can I, now that I know that I want more of this and less of this, and I feel pretty confident in saying that, I've thought about it, I've slept on it, can I get it where I am? That's the next big question if you're employed. If you're unemployed,
but that can be scary though.
Where?
So obviously, so those are two different categories. So let's talk about the people who are currently employed. And when you look at your list of I like this about my job, it's enough to stay. However, there are some cons on that list that you probably could fix. However, maybe management doesn't want to do that. They don't want to invest in that, or maybe they don't believe in that model of work, whatever it may be. What level of risk, Julie, should somebody take to go to their current employer and try to make more of a dream job out of their current role?
So I want to put a plug in right now for my program, Career Catalyst, which is available on my website, because it walks you through the entire process of putting together a one-page career plan to go talk to your boss about, or to your leader, to whoever is in charge of you, let's say, in charge of your work. There are steps that you go through to be able to have this conversation that are really built around, here's what I know about myself, here's what my reputation is, here's what my goals are, here's what I need personally. And so you go through the 7-step process that I have that walks you through how to get to the point that you are ready to have a professional, non-emotional, helpful, collaborative conversation with your leader. The outcome of Career Catalyst is a one-page career plan. Now, if you come out and you say, okay, because another piece of this is, does the organization need what it is you want to do? Do they value what you want to do? Or are you looking to do something that's not in their plan, not what they want to do? In that case, you may need to start looking for another job. But if you are working in a place where you don't feel like you can take a one-page career plan or some thoughts into your leader and say, you know, here's the things about my job I like as I look forward in my career, here are the things that I'd like to move toward doing more of. If you work in an organization where that is not a safe conversation, then I would say you need to look for a new job.
Now, I think that's a really good point. I mean, because now you're starting to question if you even work in a very healthy or a very hostile work environment. So that's a really good point. Career Catalyst, just because I know I'm going to get a bunch of calls on this. Is that on your website, thebaukegroup.com?
It is. Yeah. Okay. Career Catalyst. It is wildly affordable. It's me for 3.5 hours walking you through this entire process that we're thinking about. So if you're liking what I'm saying, but like I can't keep up, I need more. I created this program for people who are stuck, and it's whether you're 25 or 55 or 60, or what profession you're in. It really walks you through. It's me on steroids, kind of walking you through how do you do this. So the question is, once you figure out what you want to do more of, if you are not in a place where you feel like you can have that conversation, but then I would ask yourself, is that in my head or is that true? Am I just afraid to have that conversation? Do I not have the language to have that conversation? Or have I tried in the past, or have others tried and have gotten shut down? So sometimes our own fear of expressing our own desires keeps us from having the conversations, and it's mostly between our ears. And so if you can get it where you are, start moving toward it where you are. Maybe even you can volunteer to be on a committee, or you can shadow somebody for a day, or you can, how can you take little tiny steps? And if that answer is, I can't get it where I am, or this culture does not allow me to move, then you have a decision to make. This is where you start thinking about, if I can't get it here, where might I be able to get it? And these, I get it. These are questions that can make you cringe and say, and convince and try to convince yourself that the job you have isn't as bad as you really know it is at 3 o'clock in the morning. These are those crossroads where you have to decide, are you willing to put up with something that makes you miserable, or where you don't feel like you're contributing and may not make you the most wonderful person at home? Is that okay with you? And
so we're gonna,
I'm not here to judge your decisions.
Right, exactly. That's just it. It has to be individual. There's nothing uniform about this because everyone's journey is going to be totally different. Everyone's priorities are going to be different. I just really quickly want to remind folks, if you want to use Career Catalyst, it is on Julie's website, The Bauke Group, and her last name is spelled B-A-U-K-E, thebaukegroup.com. Let's get career happy, Connecticut. So we are in the planning stage of this three-piece process to getting more happy, becoming happier at your jobs with Julie Bauke, our career strategist. So we had two different people that we were dealing with. One could potentially get happier in the place of employment they're at right now. But let's say the answer is no, I have to get out of here. I got to start fresh. I have to go somewhere new. That's where we pick up Julie Bauke with the conversation here. What do you do for those folks, Julie? What would you recommend?
The first thing you want to do is start to develop a description, a vision for what you want to do next. What does it look like? What does your ideal job look like? So on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your 10? And again, put it in writing or put it down. Get it out of your head. And don't be afraid to just really swing for the fences. What does it look like? What do you do all day? How do you work? Who do you work with? What's on your desk? What's the organization? What kind of leader would you have? What kind of coworkers would you have? What would be the mission and values of the organization? Go crazy in developing your perfect 10. And, it feels really like, oh, I can't have that. I mean, we start to like, oh, no, that's impossible. Put it all down. Then you start to say, okay. So then it's time to start doing some research. And I'd love to tell you, you could put that under your pillow and the career fairy is going to come, but it ain't going to happen. You have to start getting online, looking at, so for instance, I was talking to someone yesterday who said the mission and values of the organization is really important to me. So she went online and started researching values-based organizations, best places to work. She started putting together a list of the companies that she found interesting. You can use LinkedIn as a tool. You can use your local chamber of commerce. You can use your local business publications. And then nationally, if you want to work remotely or work fully remote, there are sites. There are plenty of sites, start with Flex Jobs, that allow you to search that way. And so figure out what's most important to you and start compiling a list of the organizations who, at least on the face of it, seem to provide more of what you want. Start following them on LinkedIn. Start connecting with people. Look for people you know who might work there. Start learning about them. In other words, you are targeting. We call this a target list. And I talk about this in my book, Stop Peeing on Your Shoes, about the importance of a target list. Because the truth is, you won't work just anywhere. You want to be as focused as you can. It's kind of like putting a destination into that GPS. Start putting together a target list of organizations who, at least on the face of it, seem to have more of what you want. Then start looking through your network, connecting with people that you know, in all walks of your life or all parts of your life. Do you know anybody that works at this company? Start to follow them, see what kind of openings they have, start to apply to the ones that look to be at least a decent fit for what you're looking for. You have to have a target. Then you can start to, if you get in conversation with those companies, then you can start to determine, are they really going to be a fit for you or not? So here's the difference between the planning stage. The way we think is, sometimes people will say to me, who's hiring? Who's hiring? I'm like, you know what? That's a really bad question. The question should be, who's looking for you? Who seems to be looking for someone like you, and who do you want to work for? It's the difference between the tail wagging the dog and the dog wagging the tail. You want to be the dog. You want to say, here's who I want. Here are the kind of companies I want to work for. Then you just become a detective. Who has fully remote work? Who has a more flexible schedule? Who has a lot of customer content? Who seems to value good leadership and good culture? Who seems to prioritize their employees' mental health? Whatever it is that's important to you, once you start to put that together, it's sort of like, I want to go on my dream vacation. You say to a travel agent, I want to go on my dream vacation. He or she says, well, tell me about your dream vacation. I don't know. I just want to go on my dream vacation.
Right.
it's similar when you're looking for a job.
That's a good point.
You can't just bounce around from organization to organization, because then you start to become a bad decision maker who uses poor judgment.
You probably get more confused and you get more discouraged, and then you really do start to believe those thoughts.
Nobody will hire me.
Right.
People say, nobody's going to hire me. Well, how do you know? Well, I applied for 10 jobs online and nobody called me back. I'm like, that is not how you do it.
Right.
It's part of how you do it. I mean, obviously you have to apply for jobs, but use the analogy that I just threw out there about your dream vacation. What if someone said to you, tell me your dream job? If someone who had the power to give it to you said to you, tell me your dream job, you have to help them by identifying what that is.
Right.
And so that's a really big part of the planning, is you have to know what your destination is.
Yeah, I would say that this is probably one of the harder parts of that three-step process, because thinking about it, I think, could be overwhelming, but it's really exciting, because that's the part where you're kind of determining, okay, this is what makes me happy, this is great. But then you have to kind of, I want to say, execute it by putting a plan together and figuring it out. That could be very scary, it could be intimidating, and we don't want you to fall backwards, because next week, this is the final step that you're going to want to get the details on and really take notes on. And that is executing your plan. So we're going to talk about that next Tuesday when Julie joins us back on the show. And Julie, what would we do without you? Thank you so much.
All right. And check out Career Catalyst. It'll really put all of this into action for you, which is exactly why I created it.
Yeah, it's a great resource to have. And again, you could find that on Julie's website. It's The Bauke Group, spelled B-A-U-K-E, thebaukegroup.com.